What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. Our Resistance in Residence artist this week is writer, artist, and educator Allie Jones. Welcome to the show, Allie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Really exciting. Really excited to have you. I feel like, I mean, I clearly you've been doing the work for a long time. For me, I feel like you just like arrived in the cipher and you arrived with all this brilliance and beauty and talent and passion. And I'm like, hell yes. Another Black female playwright and writer in the orbit. So I'm glad we've collided. Start with a little bit about you. Where and how did you grow up and what was your family like?
Okay. Yeah, so I grew up in Fresno, California, Central Valley, California, with my mom and my brother. Very, you know, calm, chill, single-parent home. But the arts were always involved in some way, whether it was music or theater. And I think that the space to just explore was really exciting. I've been a writer my whole life, but I was one of those writers that, like, you only got to know I was a writer if you saw my notebook. And I wasn't sharing with a lot of people. And so I think that, yeah, it was a really beautiful space to kind of start to tip, you know, my toe into a different world that I was interested in. And then it really wasn't until college and undergrad when I was part of Vagina Monologues that I was like, oh, wait a second. This has power in a different way, like beyond entertainment, beyond just consumption, but there is power in art, you know, for movement, for change, for healing. And so I just wanted to sit with that in a lot of the different work that I did. Still, I was like, okay, maybe I'll, you know, do some memoir writing. And so it was like I was dipping into different types of writing far before I was doing any poetry. And with that, I think it was really beautiful to be able to have all these mediums to be able to explore. And often folks were like, pick a lane, pick one. And I was like, no, I feel like I speak all these languages. And so I'm going to lean into that. And so that's been a really like affirming space for me to come into now. I think Oakland has been like the epicenter of all of my not just interests, but values and ways of moving from art to writing to education to yoga, just everything. That intersection of Black women creativity is really like overwhelmingly nourishing.
What lured you, and I use that word very intentionally, what lured you to Oakland and when?
What lured you to Oakland and when? You know, I think I'd come out with a friend for a comedy show, actually. And then we would just come out for more things. And that was probably 2014. And I had just come back from studying abroad in France. And so I was like, art, culture, people. And I was living in East Palo Alto at the time. And sadly, East Palo Alto was losing those things. And so I was always in Oakland because I was like, wait, I need to see myself reflected back when I'm walking the streets. And then truly what lured me to living in Oakland was youth development. I started working with girls in East Oakland, specifically around literacy, but it really ended up being around like creative expression and wellness. And that became just like the true pull.
Well, you can't, now I'm like just veering all the way off script because UK, I know what was happening in 2014 in Oakland because I was smack dab in the middle of it. That was we had been in the streets since 2009, long before Black Lives Matter was founded. But 2014 was when that sort of exploded and there was lots and lots and lots of activity and action in the streets of Oakland. We were leading the country in a lot of that work and activity. It was also a time of really violent repression. So I'm just wondering, were you in the streets at all at the time or were you watching or how did that also maybe impact artistic inspiration or your desire to be here or
Yeah, I found myself, I think I was still in France when folks were in the street, but I do remember seeing, and then I do remember being involved in different actions when I was back in the US, and really just like supporting different realms of how folks were able to show up was really interesting to just witness. And at that point, I didn't really consider myself to be an artist yet. So I was just like a supportive educator, you know, just cheering folks on. And I think there is something about the way folks use their voice, the way folks use their platforms, the way folks are using, you know, what they're get like really the gifts that they have to amplify so much, you know, that's happening, that has been happening. And yeah, I think about various moments in Oakland that I'm like, wow, like in 2016, I was downtown at a concert. And it was interesting because, you know, folks were in the street and they had the National Guard and all of these things were happening. And the artist had a song literally called Donald Trump. And he was like, fuck that man. I'm not doing that song. I do not agree with a thing, you know, that he stands for. And for your safety, we're going to stay in here right now because, you know, they've basically blocked the doors and said, we can't go outside. And so I think about like how so much is interconnected. So many stories are hyperlinked. I talked to another friend who was like, I was outside. I was there. And I'm like, yes, exactly. Because on my way in, I was like, why is the National Guard here? And here we are, 2025. And we're seeing, you know, it's just this, the wheel spinning. And so just thinking about, you know, what does that resistance look like? What is that space look like, that space making and taking look like? And I think for me then it was like, well, I want women to come together in our creativity, in our rage, wherever we are. And so I held a weekly offering where folks could just come and like come, you know, think about where they wanted to move next, think about what was impacting them, and then really, you know, show up and think about how we wanted to do that.
I love hearing, you know, I clearly was absorbed with what was happening, you know, what my org was leading. But I love hearing what other folks, what was happening in addition to where we were, because there was so much and so much of it was artist related and inspired. And that's one of the things about the town, right? Like our work, our action, our activism has a soundtrack, music, murals, paintings, poetry, dance. Talk about art as resistance.
So when I think about art as resistance, I think about a number of things. And the first thing that comes up for me is this piece called Beloved and Insistence. And this is something that I had the honor of doing with Regina Evans in 2020. And it was a love altar installation, but it was also, you know, a space for PPE. It was also a space to really pour care into an issue, into a part of Oakland that people assume is not something people should care about or even talk about. And so specifically East 14th International. And we wanted to have a space where the beloved out there could know that we care, to know that they are loved. So there are affirmations, there were lip gloss and candy and condoms, masks. At the time, there was no one like doing any COVID testing out there. So there was also COVID testing. And so just thinking about this like love altar with plants and flowers and cotton and all sorts of things, but also having services and having performances, and the Oakland Symphony was there at one of the ones we did. And so the art attracted a lot of people to look, right? To take a moment, to sit, to be. But for us, that wasn't the core. The core of it was, you know, for folks to not just be seen, but to really be held in some way. And, you know, and seen as human, truly, because I think that when folks talk about what's happening, they definitely dehumanize these young people. And so I think that is a really beautiful example of art and resistance, because there is so much nuance there and also a lot of space for us to keep pushing back, to keep exploring, to keep coming together in question, in courage, in rage.
Allie Jones, and I know this just because I just listened to a stage reading of your piece, Saltwater Moonshine, a couple of days ago, and we'll talk about the piece in a minute, but you've got a Creole lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit about that, the migration story to California, and what connections do you still have to those roots?
Yeah, so my family moved to California from Louisiana in 1965. I had a great aunt and a great great aunt who were out here before. And the great aunt is my grandma's oldest sister. And she had come out here because she was like, I'm done. She's like, I'm going to go, you know, go somewhere where they're not trying to trick her out of her money. And, you know, she convinced my grandma and grandpa to drive the 3 days across the country, pack up their daughters. At the time, they had three. And they sold all their stuff. And I, you know, I asked my mom about this, like, what was that like? She was five. And so she's like, you know, it was long. I pouted the whole way. And it's always funny now because, you know, we've been here for, you know, so long. But I really appreciate that, for like, even though we were here, there were still so many elements of like our cultural traditions that were brought with us, whether it was the music or the food or the language. I think interesting for me, like the language didn't live outside the house. And I feel like that was a safety precaution. Like the language lived inside, you know, closed doors. Because people see Black folks speaking French and still get confused. And I'm like, I don't know why, but still get very confused. And so I think it was very much safety. And I appreciate the like Bay Area has so many Creole folks, actually. And so they were having parties. They were having zydecos all the time. They would rent out community centers and have these huge get-togethers. And I think for me growing up, I almost took it for granted just because I was like, this is what everybody's, you know, we're all just experiencing something like this. And so I think what was really beautiful for me was just being able to be immersed in Creole culture, but as like, not like, oh, we're better than Blackness, but as like another realm of Blackness, right? So just like another expression. And I feel like that was really uplifting, especially when the media is like, Creole is this one, you know, prototype of a light-skinned person who could curse you in a second but make you some good catfish, you know. And it's like, no, there's a lot of new, there's way more to that, you know.
That feels like a good segue into Saltwater Moonshine. Talk to us about it. You just had a reading at BAM House a couple days ago.
Yes, a beautiful, beautiful reading at BAM House with incredible readers and soundscapes by Brittany Tanner. The readers I had were Viva Allen, Kira Allen, and Marissa Arterberry, directed by the incredible Mona Webb.
Man.
the whole experience was really, really, truly beautiful. This piece began as a play, and 2022, I had the chance to be part of SF Batco's Creators Lab. And in that lab, we did 15 minutes at the Brava Theater Cabaret. And I was like, okay, this is beautiful. Maybe this can be longer. And then I started writing a poetry book. And I said, you know what? I'll put the poetry book out. And then if it's meant to be a play, it'll become a play. And the poetry book came out in January, and then I saw the call for BAMFest, and I was like, you know what? I have the work. Let me just put the play together. So that's what happened. And yeah, seeing it all come together in this like really harmonic way. Like the like synergies on the stage and off the stage were really just astounding.
I didn't know that you pulled it together into a play for BAMFest. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I loved that. You just talked about your process. What kind of conversations? Well, actually, give folks some plot content. You don't got to give it away, but some okay. plot content.
Yeah. So this piece explores, you know, a matrilineal legacy. So it's looking at a granddaughter, a mother, and a daughter, and the realm that spirit plays in healing, in the realm that it plays in assimilation, the realm that it plays in really preservation. And so just really holding on to culture and how we move through it. But what do we inherit in all these different places, whether it is a home, a garden, or a kitchen?
What kinds of conversations do you hope the piece inspires?
You know, the Q&A actually really got me. And I've been sitting with this idea around where the men are in this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I really set out to center Black women. And so with that, I was like, well, I hope that Black women feel loved and seen and held in some way. And those are the conversations I've been hearing. But I also do hope that it pushes Black men to consider what their role is in loving and supporting and caring for us too, beyond, you know, desire, beyond, you know, like if this person is your sister or your mother, just overall care for other people, I think is what I hope people kind of start to sit with a little bit more. And then reconsider what it means to create, to show up. I think a lot of people focus on perfection and needing the thing to be great and amazing the moment it comes out. And I think that a lot of things are developing. And so just hoping folks allow themselves the space to develop.
My family's from Monroe, Louisiana. Mm. And you said something in response to that question that jarred me. And I know it's not because we're both of our lineages are in Louisiana, but it moved it in me mm-hmm. when you said it. And that is this conversation about sexual predators inside of our family. Mm-hmm. In my family, they exist, but nobody's allowed to talk about it.
Right.
So it's like this, we all know.
Yes.
But if you say anything, right, then you're, I remember when I went to confront my perpetrator, my aunt, you know, and I was doing it in a calm way. I wouldn't scream. My aunt came and told me not to start no mess in her house. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about the silence.
Ooh, the silence is very jarring and terrifying, actually. And I think a lot about my grandma's funeral, and I have a cousin who, you know, it's like, yeah, like you said, everybody knows, but no one says anything. And one of my older cousins, so a girl cousin, her daughter was running around the church, and like about 5 minutes before I saw her running around the church, I saw him. And so I was just like, basically I had eyes on her the whole time. And my cousin was like, wait, have you seen her? And I was like, she's right there, like quickly. And I just think about how that silence created also a vigilance within all the women, you know. It created this like space where we had to be on alert. We had to be like in some kind of alarm state. And it's sad. I think it's really tragic. And I do think the other realm that is, I think the hardest is that the women who are defending, you know, these men, rather than protecting the girls.
Yeah. And you're saying that is that like, And there we go, an additional layer of labor for Black women.
Yeah.
Unseen, unspoken about, but there for so many of us. What I didn't know about you, and I got super excited about, because this is a world that is really closed off to a lot of us, and a world that's been shrinking because of how expensive it is to do. But you're the co-founder and director of Black Freighter Press. What's the mission and what kinds of stuff do you publish?
I am. Yes, we are Revolutionary Press. We publish poetry at the moment, and we really like to explore radical imagination, you know, thinking about art that can transform consciousness. And so not just art for art's sake, but art that pushes us past what we know, really towards where we could be, and in reflections of where we've been. And yeah, it's been a really beautiful space to be able to steward and connect with so many beautiful writers. I'm just like, ooh, it's funny to think about, because I, for a long time, was like, I'm not a poet. And now I'm like, I publish poetry, I teach poetry, I write poetry. Like, it's everywhere.
It's so dope. It's so dope. I got so excited. I was like, wow. Because, I mean, I know for myself, I know for other poets, you know, like when we're like, well, we don't even know where to, you know, we start putting pennies in jars because we're like, we just going to do this ourselves.
Yeah.
So that the fact, so Black women poets out there, there's a platform for you to reach out to. Yeah. I'll let them, Black Freighter Press. For you Revolutionary Black women writers. I find most Black women writers are revolutionary. Most
pretty much, most part.
Yeah, I mean, what else could we be? When you're thinking about Black art in this moment, in this political moment right now, Allie, what do you think?
Ooh. I keep first thinking about healing, and I guess that's like in the like realm of ancestral practices, I feel like folks were able to resist the levels of disruption and distraction through their spirit, their spiritual practices, you know, whatever that looked like, whether that was their prayers or their spells or, you know, their gatherings under the moon. And so just thinking about how we get back to nature, but to each other as well, I feel like there are a lot of folks who feel isolated. And so thinking about, you know, instead of thinking, oh, there's so much to do, there's so much to go, you know, be, I feel like you got to start where you are and showing up there and asking where people need support or checking in with your neighbor. Like, there's a lot of different realms that people can begin at. And I think the starting is where folks find it to be most difficult. And so, yeah, I would say just that interpersonal connection, that's where I think we need to start. I think that's what's been most disrupted in the last 7 years, I would say, like just the way we can be with each other. Mm-hmm.
Allie, if after listening to this conversation, and I'm sure they will, where should folks go to follow you, to learn more about you, to keep up with your brilliance?
Yes, you can go to alliejones.com, AlieJones.com, and all of the things are there: email, Instagram, videos, poetry, a little bit of everything.
All right, y'all. You've been listening to Resistance in Residence, where we feature artists using their talents to change the world. Our guest this week is writer, educator, and artist Allie Jones. Allie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Kat.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis. And subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.